Welcome to a reading of Gillespie's dispute against the English Popish ceremonies obtruded on the Church of Scotland. This Reformation MP3 audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free Reformation resources, as well as our complete online catalogue containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, the Puritan hard drive, digital downloads, MP3s, DVDs, and much more at great discounts, are on the web at www.puritandownloads.com. Also, please consider, pray, and act upon the important truths found in the following quotation by Charles Spurgeon. As the Apostle says to Timothy, so also he says to everyone, give yourself to reading. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read. Renounce as much as you will, or like literature, but study as much as possible sound theological works, especially the Puritanic writers and expositions of the Bible. The best way for you to spend your leisure is to be either reading or praying. And now to SWRB's reading of Gillespie's dispute against the English Popish ceremonies obtruded on the Church of Scotland, which we hope you find to be a great blessing, and we pray draws you nearer to the Lord Jesus Christ. For he is the way, the truth, and the life, and no man cometh unto the Father but by him. John 14, verse 6. To preserve the continuity of George Gillespie's remarkable argumentation in his dispute against English Popish ceremonies, this audio version does not contain readings of Gillespie's footnotes. The footnotes may be accessed in the edition of A Dispute Against English Popish Ceremonies on the Puritan hard drive or anywhere else the full text is available. The works of Mr. George Gillespie, Minister of Edinburgh, and one of the commissioners from Scotland to the Westminster Assembly, 1644, now first collected, with memoir of his life and writings by M. W. Hetherington, in two volumes, Volume 1, Edinburgh, Robert Ogle and Oliver and Boyd, M. Ogle and Son and William Collins, Glasgow, Hamilton, Adams and Co., London, 1846. Advertisement. Transcriber's note. This book is an 1846 reprint of George Gillespie's books, which were originally published separately. Each is reprinted here with an original title page and other front matter. The paper book had no page numbers. Each book is transcribed here with its own page numbering, which may have no correspondence with the publisher's idea of the page numbers. In presenting to the public for the first time a complete edition of the works of Mr. George Gillespie, there are two or three points to which the publisher begs to direct special attention. Although the great value of Gillespie's various works was well known to many, yet there had been no recent reprints of them, and they had become so very scarce that it was with great difficulty any of them could be obtained. Recent controversies have brought forward the very subjects which had been so ably treated by Gillespie, and it was felt that justice to the Church, of which he was so great an ornament, and the cause which he so strenuously supported, demanded the republication of his whole works, in a form and at a price which should render them generally accessible. In prosecuting this task, the idea was suggested that it would be desirable to publish what remained of these notes on the proceedings of the Westminster Assembly of Divines, which Gillespie was known to have written, if the permission of the advocates in whose library they were could be obtained. That permission was most readily granted. The manuscript volumes of what purported to be Gillespie's notes form part of a large collection entitled The Wodgrow Manuscripts. They appear, however, not to be Gillespie's own notes, but copies separately taken from the original. The fact that they are manifestly separate and independent transcriptions furnishes good evidence of the genuineness and authenticity of the original manuscripts, though it is not now known where they are, if still in existence. In making a new copy for the press, every facility was granted by the librarians of the Advocates' Library with their well-known courtesy and liberality. And much aid was rendered by David Lane, Esquire, a gentleman thoroughly conversant with Scottish ecclesiastical literature, and generously ready to communicate to others the benefit of his own extensive and accurate knowledge. Being desirous to render this edition of Gillespie's works as full and complete as possible, several small and comparatively unimportant papers have been copied from the Woodrow manuscript, some account of which will be found at the close of the memoir. An appendix to the memoir contains all that could be gleaned from Woodrow's Analecta, as printed in the Maitland Club. The memoir itself has been drawn up with considerable care, and is as extensive as the paucity of materials for its composition would admit. It might indeed have been enlarged by a more full account of the great events which occurred during the period in which Gillespie lived, but this would have been an unfair changing of biography into history, and would not have been suited to the object in view. As the parts of the collected edition of which Gillespie's works were issued successively, they have been paged separately and may be arranged in volumes according to the taste of their purchasers. It will, however, be found most expedient to adopt a chronological arrangement, such as is indicated in the closing pages of the memoir. Memoir of the Reverend George Gillespie. George Gillespie was one of the most remarkable men of the period in which he lived, singularly fertile as that period was in men of great abilities. He seemed to have been almost unknown till the publication of his first work, which dazzled and astonished his countrymen by the rare combination it displayed of learning and genius of the highest order. From that time forward, he held an undisputed position among the foremost of the distinguished men by whose talents and energy the Church of Scotland was delivered from prelatic despotism. Yet although greatly admired by all his compeers during his brilliant career, so very little has been recorded respecting him that we can but glean a scanty supply of materials from a variety of sources out of which to construct a brief memoir of his life. We have not met with any particular reference to the family from which George Gillespie was descended, except a very brief notice of his father, the Reverend John Gillespie, in Livingstone's Memorable Characteristics. From this we learn that he was a minister of Kirkcaldy, and that he was, to use Livingstone's language, a thundering preacher. In that town, George Gillespie was born, but as the earlier volumes of the Session Register of Births and Baptisms have been lost, the precise year of his birth cannot be ascertained from that source. It could not, however, have been earlier than 1612, in which year his father was chosen to the second charge in Kirkcaldy, as appears from the town records, not later than 1613, as the existing register commences January 1614, and in the end of that year the birth of a daughter of Mr. John Gillespie is registered, and again in 1610 of a son baptized Patrick. It may be assumed, therefore, with tolerable certainty, that George Gillespie was born early in the year 1613, a date which agrees with that engraven on his tombstone. Woodrow indeed states, on the authority of Mr. Simpson, that Gillespie was born on the 21st of January 1613. Nothing has been recorded respecting the youthful period of Gillespie's life. The earliest notice of him which appears is merely sufficient to intimate that his mind must have been carefully cultivated from his boyhood, as it relates to the time of his being sent to the University of St. Andrews to prosecute his studies in 1629, when he was, of course, in his 16th year. It appears to have been the custom of the Presbytery of Kirkcaldy, as of many others at that time, to support young men of merit at the university as presbytery bursars by means of contributions of the parishes within its bounds. In the session record of Kirkcaldy, the following statement occurs, dated November 1629. The session are content that Mr. George Gillespie shall have as much money as our session for his internment as Dysart gives, i.e. 20 merks, being our presbytery bursar. In some of the brief biographical notices of him which have been given, we are informed that during the course of his attendance at the university, he gave ample evidence of both genius and industry by the rapid growth and development of mental power and the equally rapid acquirement of extensive learning, in both of which respects he surpassed his fellow students. That this must have been the case, his future eminence, so early achieved, sufficiently proved, but nothing of a very definite nature relating to that period has been preserved. When he had completed his academic career and was ready to enter into the office of the ministry, his progress was obstructed by a difficulty which, for a time, proved insurmountable. Being conscientiously convinced that the prelatic system of church government is of human invention and not of divine institution, and having seen the bitter fruits it bore in Scotland, he would not submit to receive ordination from a bishop, and could not, at that juncture, obtain admission into the ministerial office without it. Though thus excluded from the object of his pursuit, he found congenial employment for his pious and active mind in the household of Lord Kenmure, where he resided as domestic chaplain till the death of that nobleman in September 1634. Soon afterwards we find him discharging a similar duty in the family of the Earl of Cassillis, and at the same time acting as tutor to Lord Kennedy, the Earl's eldest son. This latter employment furnished him with both leisure and inducement to prosecute his studies, and that too in the very direction to which his mind had already been predisposed. But in order to obtain an intelligible view of the state of matters in Scotland at that period, we must take a brief survey of events which had been moulding the aspect of both church and kingdom for some time before. It may be assumed, as a point which no person of competent knowledge and candid mind will deny or dispute, that the Reformed Church of Scotland was, from its very origin, Presbyterian. Equally opposed to the prelatic superiority of one minister over others, and to the authority of the civil power in spiritual matters. This point, therefore, we need not occupy space in proving, but we may suggest that there is a much closer and more important connection between the two elements here specified than is generally marked. For as a little reflection will show, without the preeminence of some small number of ministers over the rest, the civil power cannot obtain the means of directly exercising an authoritative control in spiritual matters. Even the indirect methods of corruption which may be employed can be but partially successful, and may at any time be defeated, whenever the general body shall be restored to purity and put forth its inherent power. A truly Presbyterian church, therefore, never can be thoroughly depended on by civil rulers who wish to use it as a mere engine of state for political purposes. Consequently, a truly Presbyterian church has never been found much favour in the estimation of the civil power. And it may be added, never will, till the civil power itself become truly Christian. Thus viewed, it was not strange that the civil power in Scotland, whether wielded by a regent such as Morton or a king like James VI, should strenuously and perseveringly seek the subversion of the Presbyterian Church. In the early stage of the struggle, first Morton and then James attempted force, but found the attempt to be in vain. At length the king seemed inclined to leave off the hopeless and pernicious contest, and then in the year 1592, an Act of Parliament was passed, ratifying all the essential elements of the Presbyterian Church in doctrine, government, discipline, and worship. But this proved to be merely a cessation of hostilities on the part of the king, preparatory to their resumption in a more insidious and dangerous manner, and by the dark instrumentality of his boasted kingcraft. The first indication of the crafty monarch's designs was in the year 1597, when he, of his great zeal and singular affection, which he always has to the advancement of the true religion, presently professed within his this realm, to use his own words, enacted that all who should be appointed to the prelatic dignity should enjoy the privilege of sitting and voting in Parliament. The prudence was that these persons would attend better to the interests of the Church than could be done by laymen. The intention was to introduce the prelatic order and subvert the Presbyterian Church. And this might be done quietly and perceptibly. The question respecting the influence which these parliamentary representatives of the Church should have in the government of the Church itself were left to be determined by the King and the General Assembly. Many of the most judicious and clear-sighted of the ministers perceived the dangerous tendency of this measure and gave it their decided and strenuous opposition. But others, wearied out by their conflict with the avaricious and tyrannical conduct of the nobility, which they hoped thus more effectually to resist, or gained over by the persuasions of the king and the court party, supported the proposal. The result was that the measure was carried in the Assembly of 1598 by a majority of 10, and that majority formed chiefly by the votes of the elders whom the king had induced to support his views. Scarcely had even the step been taken when the Church became alarmed at the possible consequences, and in order to avoid increasing that alarm, all further consideration of the measure with reference to its subordinate details was postponed till the meeting of the next assembly. Nor was this enough. As the time for the next assembly drew near, the king felt so uncertain of success that he prorogued the appointed meeting and betook himself to those private artifices by which his previous conquest had been gained. When the assembly of 1600 met, the most intense interest was felt by the whole kingdom in its proceedings, all men perceiving that upon its decision would depend the continuation or overthrow of the Presbyterian form of church government in Scotland. The king's first step was the arbitrary exclusion from the assembly of the celebrated Andrew Melville. The discussion commenced respecting the propriety of ministers voting in Parliament. But when those who favoured the measure could not meet the argument of its opponents, the king again interposed and authoritatively declared that the preceding General Assembly had already decided the general question in the affirmative, and that they had now only to determine subordinate arrangements. The measure was thus saved from defeat. The next question, whether the parliamentary ministers should hold their place for life or be manually elected, was decided in favour of annual election. Yet James prevailed upon the cleric to frame an ambiguous statement in the minute of proceedings, virtually granting that the assembly had rejected. Even then, though thus both overborne and tricked by the king, the church framed a number of carefully expressed caveats or cautions for protecting her liberties and guarding against the introduction of prelacy. It was not, however, the intention of the king to pay any regard to these caveats, as soon as he might think it convenient to set them aside, and accordingly, within a few months, he appointed 3 bishops to the vacant sees of Ross, Aberdeen, and Caithness, directly in violation of all the caveats by which he had agreed that the appointment of ecclesiastical commissioners to Parliament should be regulated. That mysterious event, the Gowrie conspiracy, and the views taken of it by some of the best and most influential of the ministers, tended to alter the aspect of the struggle between the king and the church. And though the king twice interposed to change the assembly's time and place a meeting by his own authority, contrary to the provisions of the Act 1592, yet the church succeeded in maintaining a large measure of its primitive freedom and purity against the encroachments of the crafty and perfidious monarch and his creatures, to use their own phrase, the bishops. The assembly of 1602, however, was the last that retained anything like Presbyterian liberty and ventured to act on its own convictions of duty. But the death of Queen Elizabeth and the accession of James to the English throne directed his attention for a time to other matters and gave occasion to a temporary pause in his violations of all the laws which he had repeatedly sworn to maintain. The pause was brief. The flattering servility of the English bishops inflated his vanity to an extravagant degree and rendered him the mere determined to subvert wholly the Presbyterian Church of Scotland and to erect prelacy on its ruins. He had already presumed more than once to postpone meetings of the General Assembly by his own arbitrary authority. He resumed his discourse, postponed the assembly for 1 year, naming another, then prorogued it again without naming another day of meeting, which was nearly equivalent to an intimation that it should entirely depend upon his pleasure whether it should ever meet again, directly contrary to the Act 1592, in which it was expressly stipulated that the assembly should meet at least once a year. The most zealous and faithful of the ministers were now fully aware of the imminent peril to which spiritual liberty was exposed. On the 2nd of July 1605, the day in which the General Assembly had been appointed to meet at Aberdeen, 19 ministers met, constituted the assembly in the usual form, and while engaged in reading a letter presented by the King's Commissioner, a messenger at arms entered and in the King's name charged them to dismiss on pain of being held guilty of rebellion. The moderator appointed another day of meeting and dissolved the assembly in the usual manner. This bold and independent, though perfectly legal and constitutional conduct, roused the wrath of the king to fury. 6 of the most eminent of the ministers, one of whom was John Welsh of Ayr, son-in-law of Knox, were confined in a miserable dungeon in the castle of Blackness for the period of 14 months, and then banished to France. 8 others were imprisoned for a time, and banished to the remotest parts of Scotland. The severity of Robert Bruce's treatment was increased, and 6 other ministers, who had not been directly involved in the resistance to the king's authority, by the suppressed assembly of Aberdeen, were called to London, and engaged in captious disputations by the crafty monarch and his sycophantic prelates, in order to find occasion against them also. The result was the confinement in the Tower of Andrew Melville, and his subsequent banishment to France, and the prohibition of his nephew James Melville to return to Scotland. Having thus succeeded by fraud and force in cutting off the leading ministers, James next assumed an assembly to meet at Linlithgow in December 1606, naming the persons who were to be sent by the presbyteries. In this packed assembly he succeeded in his design of introducing more generally the prelatic element by the appointment of constant moderators in each presbytery. Advancing now with great rapidity, he instituted in 1610 the Court of High Commission, which may be well termed the Scottish Inquisition, and in the same year, in an assembly held at Glasgow, both nominated by the king and corrupted by lavish bribery, the whole prelatic system of church government was introduced. The right of calling and dismissing assemblies was declared to belong to the royal prerogative. The bishops were declared moderators of diocesan synods. The power of excommunicating and absolving offenders was conferred on them. The government of the church was thus completely subverted in its external aspect. Its forms indeed remained. There were still presbyteries and synods, and there might be a general assembly, if the king pleased, but the power of presbyteries or synods was vested in the prelates, and the king could prevent any assembly from being held as long as he thought proper. But the Presbyterian church, though overborne, was not destroyed, nor was its free spirit wholly subdued. When in 1617 the king attempted to arrogate to himself and his prelatic council the power of enacting ecclesiastical laws, he was immediately met by a protestation against a measure so despotic. By an arbitrary stretch of power, he banished the historian Calderwood, the person who presented to him the protestation, but he felt it necessary to have recourse once more to his previously employed scheme of a packed and bribed assembly in which to enact his innovations. This was accordingly done in the Assembly of 1618, held in Perth, in which, by the joint influence of bribery and intimidation, he succeeded in obtaining a majority of votes in favour of the Five Articles of Perth, as they are usually called. These five articles were kneeling at the communion, the observance of holidays, episcopal confirmation, private baptism, and the private dispensation of the Lord's Supper. It will at once be seen that these innovations were directly contrary to the Presbyterian principle, which holds that human inventions ought not to be added to divine institutions. This was the last attempt made by King James for the overthrow of the Presbyterian Church. It was but partially successful. Not less than 45, even of the ministers summoned to Perth by the king, voted against the five articles, and in defiance of the authority of the king and the prelates and the terrors of the Court of High Commission, a large proportion of the ministers and a much larger proportion of the people throughout the kingdom never conformed to these articles. Various attempts were made by the prelatic faction to suppress the resistance of the faithful ministers and people. At one time a minister who would not yield was suspended from his ministry, at another he was banished from his flock and confined to some remote district of the country. But all was ineffectual, although much suffering and distress of mind was caused by these harassing persecutions. Very gladly would the ministers and people have abandoned the prelatized church and maintained the government and ritual of the church of their fathers by their own unaided exertions, had they been permitted. But no such permission could be obtained. They were compelled either to abstain from preaching altogether, or to remain in connection with the church. And even this alternative was not always left to their choice. They were frequently kept in a species of imprisonment in their own houses, not permitted to leave the church, yet forbidden to preach, or even to expound the word of God to the members of their own households. Such was the monstrous and intolerable tyranny exercised by prelacy in Scotland in its desperate attempts to destroy the Presbyterian Church. But the Presbyterian Church has always proved to be not easily destroyed. At the very time when prelacy and kingcraft were uniting for its destruction, its divine head was graciously supporting it under its trials, giving it life to endure and preparing for its deliverance. The sufferings endured by the faithful ministers in many parts of the country tended to make them objects of admiration, love, and respect to the people, who could not but draw a very striking contrast between their conduct and that of the haughty and irreligious prelates. But mighty as was this influence in the hearts of the people, one infinitely more mighty began to be felt in many districts of the kingdom. God was pleased to grant a time of religious revival. The power of vital godliness aroused the land, shining its strength like living fire. At Stuart and at Shotts, and in many other quarters, great numbers were converted, and the faith of still greater numbers was increased. A time of refreshing from the presence of God had evidently come, and it soon became equally evident that the enemies of spiritual freedom were under the blinding influence of infatuation. The younger bishops, inflated with vanity, acted towards the Scottish nobility in a manner so insolent as to rouse the pride of those stern and haughty barons. But the prelates had learned from Laud what measures would be agreeable to Charles I, who to all his father's despotic ideas of royal prerogative and love of prelacy, and to at least equal dissimulation, added the formidable elements of a temper dark and relentless, and a proud and inflexible will. The consequences soon appeared. Charles resolved that the Church of Scotland should not only be Episcopalian in its form of government, but also in all its discipline and its form of worship. In order to accomplish this long-wished-for purpose, it was resolved that a book of canons and a liturgy should be prepared by the Scottish bishops and transmitted to those of England for their revision and approval. The Book of Canons appeared in 1635 and was regarded by the nation with the utmost abhorrence, both on its own account and as intended to introduce innovations still more detested. What was dreaded soon took place. The liturgy was prepared, sent to England, and revised, several of the corrections being written by Laud himself, all tending to give it a decidedly popish character. Some copies of this production appeared early in the year 1637 and were immediately subjected to the examination of acute and powerful minds, well able to detect and expose their errors, and to resist this tyrannical attempt to do violence to the conscience of a free and religious people. The crisis came. A letter from His Majesty was procured, requiring the liturgy to be used in all the churches of Edinburgh, and an act of the Privy Council was passed to enforce obedience to the royal mandate. Archbishop Spotswood summoned the ministers together, announced to them the king's pleasure, and commanded them to give intimation from their pulpits that on the following Sabbath the public use of the liturgy was to be commenced. The 23rd day of July, 1637, was that on which the perilous attempt was to be made. In the Cathedral Church of St. Giles, the Dean of Edinburgh, attired in his surplice, began to read the service of the day. At that moment, an old woman called Jenny Geeds, unable longer to restrain her indignation, exclaimed, "Villain, dost thou say mass at my lug?" And seizing the stool on which she had been sitting, threw it at the Dean's head. Instantly all was uproar and confusion. Threatened or assailed on all sides, the Dean, terrified by this sudden outburst of popular fury, tore himself out of their hands and fled, glad to escape, though with the loss of his priestly vestments. In vain did the magistracy interfere. It was impossible to restore sufficient quiet to allow the service to be resumed, and the defeated prelatic party were compelled to abandon the liturgy, thus dashed out of their trembling grasp by a woman's hand. Such was the state of affairs in both church and kingdom when George Gillespie first appeared in public life. He had already refused to receive ordination at the hands of a bishop. He had marked well the pernicious effects of their conduct on the most sacred interests of the community, and his strong and active intellect was directed to the prosecution of such studies as might the better enable him to assail the wrong and defend the right. His residence in the household of the Earl of Cassilis, while it furnished the means of continuing his learned researches, was not likely to change their direction, for the Earl was one of those high-hearted and independent noblemen who could not brook prelatic insolence, even when supported by the sovereign's favour. The first production from the pen of Gillespie, the fruit, doubtless, of his previous studies, was a work entitled A Dispute Against the English Popish Ceremonies Obtruded Upon the Church of Scotland. His publication was remarkably well-timed, being in the summer of 1637, at the very time when the whole kingdom was in a state of intense excitement, in the immediate expectation that the liturgy would be forced upon the church. Nothing could have been more suited to the emergency. It encountered every kind of argument employed by the prelatic party, and as the defenders of the ceremonies argued that they were either necessary or expedient or lawful or indifferent, so Gillespie divided his work into four parts, arguing against their necessity, their expediency, their lawfulness, and their differentiae, with such extensiveness of learning and acuteness of power of reasoning as completely to demolish all the arguments of all his prelatic antagonists. The effect produced by this singular able work may be conjectured from the fact that within a few months after its publication, a proclamation was issued by the Privy Council at the instigation of the bishops, commanding all the copies of it that could be found to be called in and burned. Such was the only answer that all the learned Scottish prelates could give to a treatise, written by a youth who was only in his 25th year when it appeared. The language of Bailey shows the estimation in which that learned but timid and cautious man held Gillespie's youthful work. This same youth is now given out also, by those that should know, for the author of the English Popish Ceremonies, whereof we all do marvel, for though he had gotten the papers and help of the chief of that side, yet the very composition would seem to be far above such an age. But if that book be truly of his making, I admire the man, though I mislike much of his matter, yet I think he may prove amongst the best wits of this isle. So far as argument was concerned, the controversy was ended by Gillespie's work, as no answer was ever attempted by the prelates. But the contest, which began as one of power against principle, ere long became one of power against power. In vain did the king attempt to overawe the firm minds of the Presbyterians. In vain did the bishops issue their commands to their ministers to use the liturgy. These commands were universally disobeyed, for the spirit of Scotland was now fairly roused, a spirit which has often learned to conquer, but never to yield. It was to be expected that Gillespie would not be allowed to remain much longer in comparative obscurity after his remarkable abilities had become known. The church and parish of Wemyss being at that time vacant, the congregation, to whom he had been known from his infancy, made supplication that he might be their minister. This request was granted. Morg St. Andrew's beard, as Bailey says, that is, in spite of the opposition made by Spotswood, Archbishop of St. Andrew's, who knew enough of the young man to regard him with equal fear and hatred. He was ordained by the Presbytery of Kirkcaldy on the 26th of April, 1638. The celebrated Robert Douglas, at that time minister of Kirkcaldy, presiding at the ordination, and was the first who was admitted by a presbytery at that period without regard to the authority of the bishops. This indeed soon ceased to be a singularity, but it must be remembered that though the attempt to impose the liturgy upon the church had been successfully resisted, the ostensible government of the church was still held by the prelates, and continued to be held by them, till they were all disposed by the famous General Assembly, which met in Glasgow on the 21st day of November 1638. But their power had received a fatal blow, and it could not fail to be highly gratifying to George Gillespie that the first free act of the Presbyterian Church, to the recovery of whose liberty he had so signally contributed, should be his own ordination to the ministerial office. From that time forward, the life of George Gillespie was devoted to the public service of the Church, and he was incessantly engaged in all the great measures of that momentous period. He, however, was not the man of the age. That man was Alexander Henderson, the acknowledged leader of the Church of Scotland's Second Reformation. And as it is not our purpose to write a history of that period, we must confine ourselves chiefly to those events in which Gillespie acted a prominent part. The next intimation that we receive of Gillespie is in Bailey's account of the Glasgow Assembly. After a sermon of Mr. Gillespie, says Bailey, wherein the youth very learnedly and judiciously, as they say, handled the words, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord," yet did too much encroach on the king's actions, he, Argyle, gave as a grave admonition to let authority alone, which the moderator seconded, and we all religiously observed, so long as the assembly lasted. This proves at least that Gillespie was highly esteemed by his brethren, who had selected him as one to preach before that important assembly, notwithstanding his youth. It should be added that on consulting the records of the assembly's proceedings, we do find Argyle's grave admonition not to interfere with the authority due to the king in his own province, and the moderator's answer, but nothing to lead us to think that it had any reference to Gillespie's sermon. Bailey had not, at that time, learned to know and appreciate Gillespie, as he did afterwards, and as he had been somewhat startled by the point and power of the English popish ceremonies, he might not unnaturally conclude that Argyle's caution against what might be had been caused by what had already been beginning to appear in the language of the youthful preacher. The course of public affairs swept rapidly onward, though certainly not in such a channel as to gratify the lovers of arbitrary power and superstition. The king, enraged to find his beloved prelacy overthrown at once and entirely, prepared to force it upon the Scottish Covenanted Church and people by force of arms. The Covenanters stood on the defensive and met the invading host on the border, prepared to die rather than submit to the loss of religious liberty. But the English army was little inclined to fight in such a cause. They had felt the king's tyranny and the oppression of their own prelates, and were not disposed to destroy that liberty so nobly won by Scotland, for which they were themselves most earnestly longing. A peace ensued. The king granted that spiritual liberty which he was unable to withhold, and the ministers who had accompanied the Scottish army returned to the discharge of their more peaceful duties. But this peace proved of short duration. The king levied a new and more powerful army, and again declared war against his Scottish subjects. Again the Covenanters resumed their weapons of defence and marched towards the border, a number of the most eminent ministers, among whom was Gillespie, being required to accompany the army and empowered to act as presbytery. It was, however, judged necessary to anticipate the approach of the English by entering England. The bold movement changed the nature of the contest for the time, because the English Parliament felt the utmost jealousy of the king's despotic designs and would not grant him the necessary support. Negotiations for peace were begun at Ripon and transferred to London. This rendered it necessary for the Scottish commissioners for the peace to reside at London. Henderson, Blair, Bailey and Gillespie accompanied the commissioners to London, resided with them there in the capacity of chaplains, and availed themselves of the opportunity thus afforded for proving to the people of England that Presbyterian ministers were not such rude and ignorant men as their prelatic calumniators had asserted. The effect of their preaching was astonishing, even at Clarendon, their prejudiced and bitter rival amidst. Wherever they preached, the people flocked in crowds to hear them, and even clustered round the doors and windows of the church in which they were proclaiming the unsearchable riches of Christ. It soon became apparent that both the cause and the men by whom it was defended were too mighty to be despised. Courtly parasites might scoff, but the heart of England was compelled to know that living faith and true eloquence are equally powerful to move and guide the minds of men, whether on the bleak waste of a Scottish moor or in the midst of a mighty city. Soon after the return of the Scottish commissioners and ministers in the Assembly of 1641, the town of Aberdeen gave a call to George Gillespie, to one of his pastors. This call, however, he strenuously and successfully resisted, and was permitted to remain at Wemyss. But next year the town of Edinburgh applied to the General Assembly to have him translated to one of the charges there, and his application was successful, so that he became one of the ministers of Edinburgh in the year of 1642, and continued so during the remainder of his life. But although Edinburgh had succeeded in obtaining Gillespie, the citizens were not long permitted to enjoy the benefit of his ministry. Another class of duties awaited him, in a still more public and important sphere of action. It is impossible here to do more than refer to the great events which at that time agitated not only Scotland, but also England. The superstition, bigotry, and intolerance of Archbishop Laud and his followers, combining with and urging on the despotism of the king, had at length completely exhausted the patience of the English people and Parliament. Every pacific effort had proved fruitless, and had become undeniably evident to every English patriot that prelacy must be abolished, and the royal prerogative limited, unless they were prepared to yield up every vestige of civil and religious liberty. They made the nobler choice, passed an act abolishing prelacy, and summoned an assembly of divines to deliberate respecting the formation of such a confession of faith, catechism, and directory, as might lead to uniformity between the churches of the two kingdoms, and thereby tend to secure the religious liberty of both. The Assembly of Divines met at Westminster on the first day of July 1643. Soon afterwards, commissioners from the English Parliament and from the Westminster Assembly were appointed to proceed to Edinburgh, to be present at the meeting of the General Assembly in August, and to seek a conference respecting the best method of forming the basis of a religious and civil confederacy between the two kingdoms in their time of mutual danger. These commissioners, accordingly, attended the meeting of the Assembly in Edinburgh, and the result of their conferences was the framing of that well-known bond of union between the two countries, the Solemn League and Covenant, a document which we may be pardoned by terming the noblest in its essential nature and principles of all that are recorded among the international transactions of the world. As the main object for which the Solemn League and Covenant was framed was to secure the utmost practical degree of uniformity in the religious worship of both countries, and as the English divines had already met at Westminster to take the whole subject into consideration, and had requested the assistance of commissioners from the Church of Scotland, the General Assembly named some of the most eminent of their ministers and elders as commissioners to the General Assembly, Westminster Assembly. These were Alexander Henderson, Robert Douglas, Robert Bailey, Samuel Rutherford, and George Gillespie, ministers, and the Earl of Cassillis, Lord Maitland, and Sir Archibald Johnson of Warriston, elders, but neither the Earl of Cassilis nor Robert Douglas went. Three of these, Lord Maitland, Henderson and Gillespie, set off for London, along with the English commissioners, immediately after the rising of the General Assembly, and the other three, Warrison, Rutherford and Bailey, followed about a month afterwards. On the 15th of September, the Scottish commissioners were received into the Westminster Assembly with great kindness and courtesy, and on the 25th of the same month, the Solemn League and Covenant was publicly sworn and subscribed by both Parliament and Assembly, after addresses by Nyoe and Henderson. It was not, however, till the 12th of October that the Westminster Assembly commenced its serious deliberations concerning church government, discipline, and a directory of worship, in the hope of arriving at such conclusions as might produce religious uniformity in the churches of England, Scotland, and Ireland, if not also with the Reformed churches of the continent. Scarcely had the Westminster Assembly begun its deliberations when it became abundantly apparent that however sincere in its members might be in the desire to promote the religious welfare of the community, they were nevertheless divided in their views as to how that could be best accomplished. There were three parties in the Assembly: the Presbyterians, the Independents, and the Erastians. Of these, the Presbyterians formed by far the most numerous, comprising at least 9/10 of the entire body. There were, at first, only 5 independent divines, commonly termed the 5 dissenting brethren, but their number finally amounted to 10 or 11. Only 2 ministers were decided Erastians, but a considerable number of the parliamentary members, chiefly those who were professionally lawyers, advocated that secular policy. The Scottish commissioners refused to exercise the right of voting, but were continually present in the Assembly and took a very prominent part in all its deliberations and debates, supporting, as might be expected, the views of the Presbyterians. The chief strength of the Independents consisted in the tenacity with which they adhered to their own opinions, disputing every proposition brought forward by others, but cautiously abstaining from giving any definite statement of their own, and in the close intercourse which they contrived to keep with Cromwell and the military Independents. And the Erastian party, though few in number within the Assembly itself, possessed nevertheless considerable influence, arising out of their reputation for learning, having as their ornament and support that distinguished man, emphatically called the Learned Selden. But the true source of their power was the Parliament, which, having deprived the King of that ecclesiastical supremacy which he had so grievously abused, wished to retain it in its own possession, and therefore supported the Erastian party in the Assembly. Numerous and protracted were the debates which arose in the Westminster Assembly during the discussion of the various topics on which these three parties differed in opinion, and in all those debates no person took a more active part or gained more distinction than George Gillespie. His previous course of studies had rendered him perfectly familiar with all that had been written on the subjects under discussion. His originally acute and powerful intellect had been thoroughly trained and exercised to his highest degree of clearness and vigour, and to a natural, perspicuous, and flowing readiness of language, the warmth and earnestness of his heart added the energy and elevation which formed the very essence of true eloquence. We have already referred to the high expectations which Bailey entertained of his future career, but high as these had been, they were far suppressed by the reality, as he himself declares. None in all the company did reason more and more pertinently than Mr. Gillespie. That is an excellent youth. My heart blesses God in his behalf. Very learned and acute Mr. Gillespie, a singular ornament of our church, than whom not one in the whole assembly speaks to better purpose and with better acceptance by all the hearers. Mr. George Gillespie, however, I had a good opinion of his gifts. that I profess he had much deceived me. Of a truth, there is no man whose parts in public dispute I do so admire. He has studied so accurately all the points that ever yet come to our assembly. He has got so ready, so assured, so solid a way of public debating, that however there be in the assembly divers very excellent men, yet in my poor judgment there is not one who speaks more rationally and to the point than that brave youth has ever done. We cannot here follow the course of the prolonged deliberations in which Gillespie so greatly distinguished himself, but there is one instance of his eminence which has so often been related, and not always very accurately, that it would be unpardonable not to give it here, especially as some pains have been taken to obtain as full and correct a version of it as now practical. After the Westminster divines had agreed respecting the office bearers whose permanent continuation in the church can be proved from scriptural authority, they proceeded to inquire concerning the subject of church discipline. In this the Presbyterians were constrained to encounter both the Independents and the Erastians, for the Independents on the one hand denied any authoritative excommunication or suspension, and the Erastians on the other admitted such a power but placed it in the hands of the civil magistracy. For a considerable time the discussion was between the Presbyterians and the Independents. But when the arguments of the latter party had been conclusively met and answered by their antagonists, the Erastians hastened to the rescue, and their champion, the learned Selden, came to the assembly, when the discussion drew near its close, prepared to pour forth all his learning for the discomfiture of the hitherto triumphant Presbyterians. His intention had been made known extensively, and even before the date began, the house was crowded by all who could claim or obtain admission. Gillespie, who had been probably engaged in some committee business as usual, was rather late in coming, and upon his arrival, not being recognised as a member by those who were standing about the door and in the passages, were told that it was impossible for him to get in, and the throng was so dense. "Can you not admit a peening?" said he, using a word employed by masons to indicate the thin slips of stone which they pin or fill up the chinks and inequalities that occur in a building of a plain wall. He did, however, work his way to the seat allotted to the Scottish commissioners and took his place beside his brethren. The subject under discussion was the text, Matthew 18:15-17, as bearing upon the question respecting excommunication. Selden arose in a long and elaborate speech, and with great display of minute rabbinical lore, strove to demonstrate that the passage contained no warrant for ecclesiastical jurisdiction, but that it related to the ordinary practice of the Jews in their common civil courts, by whom, as he asserted, one sentence was excommunication, pronounced by their own authority. Somewhat confused, if not appalled, by the vast erudition displayed, even the most learned and able of the divines seemed in no haste to encounter their formidable opponent. At length, both Hurle and Marshall, two very distinguished men, attempted answers, but failed to counteract the effect of Selden's speech. Gillespie had been observed by his Scottish brethren writing occasionally in his notebook, as if marking the heads of Selden's argument, and on one of them, some accounts say, Rutherford, turning to him in this emergency, said, "Rise, George, rise up, man, and defend the right of the Lord Jesus Christ to govern, by his own laws, the church which he had purchased with his blood." Thus urged, Gillespie arose, gave first a summary of Selden's argument, divesting it of all the confusion of that lumbrous learning in which it had been wrapped, and reducing it to its simple elements. Then, in a speech of singular acuteness and power, completely refuted it, proving that the passage could not be interpreted or explained away to mean a mere reference to a civil court. By 7 distinct arguments he proved that the whole subject was of a spiritual nature, not within the cognizance of civil courts, and he proved also that the Church of the Jews both possessed and exercised the power of spiritual senses. The effect of Gillespie's speech was so great as not only to convince the assembly, but also to astonish and confound Seldon himself, who is reported to have explained in a tone of bitter mortification, "That young man, by his single speech, has swept away the learning and labour of 10 years of my life." Those who were clustered together in the passage near the door remember Gillespie's expression when he was attempting to enter, said one to another, "It was well that we admitted the pinning, otherwise the building would have fallen." Even his Scottish brethren, although well acquainted with his great abilities, were surprised with his masterly analysis of Seldon's argument, and looked into his notebook, expecting there to find the outline of the summary which he had given. Their surprise was certainly not diminished when they found that he had written nothing but "Da Lucem Domine," "Lord give light," and similar brief petitions for the direction of that divine head and king of the church whose crown rights he was about to defend. Various anecdotes have been recorded respecting Gillespie's singular skill and ability in debate, but the proceeding is at once the most striking and most and best authenticated, and may suffice to prove his eminence both in learning and in power of argument among the Westminster divines. The first part of the task in which the Westminster Assembly was engaged was the framing of a directory for public worship. This having been completed about the close of the year 1644, the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland met on the 23rd of January 1645 to take this directory into consideration and to give it their sanction should it be found satisfactory. Bailey and Gillespie were sent to Scotland to be present at the assembly that they might introduce the subject and give any explanation that might appear necessary and do everything in their power to procure for it the desired approbation. In this they were completely successful, and the assembly passed an act sanctioning the directory, that act having been written, as Bailey informed us, by Gillespie. Having accomplished the object of their mission, they returned to London, where Gillespie was speedily engaged in the Erastian controversy, during which he produced his greatest work. We have already referred to the distinguished ability with which Gillespie encountered and defeated Seldon in the discussion which arose within the Westminster Assembly itself. But the principles of Erastianism were entertained by many who were not members of that assembly and were advocated in other quarters so as lead to a literary controversy. The Reverend Thomas Coleman, one of the Erastians' divines, the other being Lightfoot, preached a sermon before the House of Commons on the 30th of July 1645. In which there was a peculiar display of Erastianism of the very strongest kind. This sermon was printed, as were all sermons preached before either house, and excited at once the disapprobation of all the friends of religious liberty. It did not remain long unanswered. On the 27th of August the same year, Gillespie preached before the House of Lords, and when his sermon was also published, he added to it an appendix entitled "A Brotherly Examination of Some Passages of Mr. Coleman's Late Printed Sermon." In this appendix, Gillespie not only answered and refuted Coleman, but turned his arguments completely against himself. Coleman soon afterwards published a pamphlet entitled "A Brotherly Examination Re-examined." To this, Gillespie replied in another book bearing the title "Nihil Respondes," in which he somewhat sharply exposed the weak and inconclusive character of his opponent's argument. Irritated by the castigation he had received, Coleman published a bitter reply, which he gave the somewhat intelligible title of "Male Disis Maledicis," intending probably to insinuate that Gillespie's answer was of a reigning character. This roused Gillespie and induced him to put forth his controversial power in a singular, vigorous pamphlet entitled Male Ordis, in which he took a rapid survey of the whole Erastian controversy, so far as Coleman and some of his friends had brought it forward, convicted him and them of numerous self-contradictions, of unsoundness in theology, of violating the covenant which they had sworn, and of inculcating opinions fatal to both civil and religious liberty. To this powerful production, Coleman attempted no reply, nor have its arguments ever been answered by any subsequent advocate of Erastianism. But however able and well-timed these controversial pamphlets were, they were not enough to occupy even the few spare hours that Gillespie was able to snatch from his attendance on the business of the assembly. He had planned, and was all the while prosecuting, a much larger work. That work appeared about the close of the year 1646, under the title of Aaron's Rod Blossoming, or the Divine Ordinance of Church Government Vindicated. In this remarkably able and elaborate production, Gillespie took up the Erastian controversy as stated and defended by his ablest advocates, fairly encountering their strongest arguments and assailing their most formal propositions in the frank and fearless manner of a man thoroughly sincere and thoroughly convinced of the truth and goodness of his cause. As it may be presumed that the readers of this memoir are also in possession of Aaron's rod, we need not occupy space in giving even a brief outline of that admirable work. But as we are convinced that the Erastian conflict, which has been recently resumed, must still be fought and will be ultimately won, we strenuously recommend the studious perusal of Gillespie's masterly production to all who wish fully to comprehend the subject. One or two points of general information, however, it may be expedient to give. In the Aaron's Rod, while Gillespie intentionally traversed the whole ground of the Erastian controversy, he directed also special attention to the productions of the day. This he could not avoid, but this has tended, unfortunately, to give his work the appearance of being to some extent, an ephemeral production, suited to the period when it appeared, but not so well suited to the present times. It addresses itself to answer the arguments of Selden and Coleman and Hussey and Prynne, and as the writings of these men have sunk into oblivion, we are liable to regard the work which answered them as one which has done its deed and may also be allowed to disappear. Let it be observed that Erastianism never had abler advocates than the above-named men. Selden was so preeminent for learning that his distinguishing designation was the learned Selden. Coleman was so thoroughly conversant with Hebrew literature that he was commonly termed Rabbi Coleman. Hussey, minister of Chislehurst in Kent, was a man of great eloquence, both as a speaker and a writer, and possessed no small influence among the strong-minded men of that period. And Prynne had a double claim on public attention, both then and still, for he had been so formidable an antagonist of the Laudian prelacy, prelacy, as to have worked out by Laud as a special victim, had been condemned by the pillory and suffered the loss of both his ears by the sentence of that cruel prelate, and had been rescued from his sufferings and restored to political life and influence by the Long Parliament. He was, moreover, a learned man, an acute lawyer, and an able and subtle controversialist, and his writings exercised at the time no mean influence. When such men undertake the advocacy of the Erastian argument, encouraged as they were by the English Parliament, it may well be conceived that they would present it both in its ablest and its most plausible form, and is doing no discredit to Erastians of the present day to say that they are not likely to produce anything either more profound in learning or more able and acute in reasoning than was done by their predecessors of the Long Parliament and the Westminster Assembly. If therefore Gillespie's Aaron's Rod completely defeated the acute and able men of that day, we may well recommend it to the perusal of those whose duty it may be to engage in a similar controversy in our present age. But while such were Gillespie's labours in the field of controversy, the value of which could not be easily overestimated, his memory would be grievously wronged were we to regard him only as a controversialist. For although the topics which first engaged the attention of the Westminster Assembly were those in which the greatest difference of opinion existed, and to which almost of necessity the public mind, both then and ever since, has been most strongly directed, there was a very large portion of their duty, and that too of the highest importance and demanding the utmost care, in which a much greater degree of unanimity prevailed. For a considerable time after the Assembly commenced its deliberations, his attention was almost exclusively occupied with the framing of directories for public worship and ordination, and with discussions respecting the form of church government, including the power of church censor. These topics involved both the independent and the Erastian controversies. Until some satisfactory conclusions had been reached on these points, the Assembly abstained from entering upon the less agitating but not less important work of framing a confession of faith. But having completed their task, so far as depended upon themselves, they then turned their attention to their doctrinal labours. The manner in which the Assembly entered upon this solemn duty deserves the utmost attention, as intimating the earnest and prudent spirit by which their whole deliberations were pervaded. They appointed a committee to prepare and arrange the main propositions which were to be examined and digested into a system by the Assembly. The members of the committee were Dr. Hoyle, Dr. Goge, Messrs. Hurl, Gattaker, Turkney, Reynolds and Bynes, with the Scottish commissioners Henderson, Bailey, Rutherford and Gillespie. Those learned and able divines began their labours by arranging, in the most systematic order, the various great and second truths which God has revealed to man, and then reduced these to 32 distinct heads or chapters, each having a title expressive of its subject. These were again subdivided into sections, and the committee formed themselves into several subcommittees, each of which took a specific topic for the sake of exact and concentrated deliberation. When these subcommittees had completed their respective tasks, the whole results were laid before the entire committee, and any alterations suggested and debated till all were of one mind. And when any title or chapter had been thus fully prepared by the committee, it was reported to the Assembly, and again subjected to the most minute and careful investigation in every paragraph, sentence, and even word. All that learning, the most profound intellect and the most searching, and piety the most sincere could accomplish, was thus concentrated in the Westminster Assembly's Confession of Faith, which may be safely termed the most perfect statement of systematic theology ever framed by the Christian Church. In the preliminary deliberations of the committee, the Scottish divines took a leading part, and none more than Gillespie, but no report of these deliberations either was or could be made public. The results alone appeared when the committee, from time to time, laid its matured propositions before the Assembly, and it is gratifying to be able to add that throughout the deliberations the Assembly itself, when composing, or rather formally sanctioning the Confession of Faith, there prevailed almost an entire and perfect harmony. There appears indeed to have been only two subjects on which any difference of opinion existed among them. Well, the one of these was the doctrine of election, concerning which Bailey informs us that they had long and tough debates. The other was concerning that which heads the chapter entitled of Church Censures, as its fundamental proposition, that is, the Lord Jesus Christ as King and Head of His Church, has therein appointed a government in the hand of church officers distinct from the civil magistrate. This proposition, the assembly, manifestly intended and understood to contain a principle directly and necessarily opposed to the very essence of Erastianism. And it was regarded in the same light as the Erastians themselves. Hence, it had to encounter their most strenuous opposition. It was, however, somewhat beyond the grasp of the lay members of the assembly, especially since their champion, Selden, had in great measure withdrawn from the debates after his signal discomfiture by Gillespie, and consequently it was triumphantly carried. The single dissentient voice being that of Lightfoot, the other Erastian divine, Coleman having died before the conclusion of the debate. The framing of the confession occupied the assembly nearly a year. After having been carefully transcribed, it was presented to the Parliament on the 3rd of December 1646. This recording ends at this stage of 3rd of December 1646.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.